his life. He said, I wrote that book as I began to realize that the church was becoming fat and comfortable and lazy, and there was a lost world out there. And as I looked at the commandment of Jesus Christ, he said, again and again I saw the challenge to go to the poor, because there are more poor than anything else in this world, and you always have them with you. And so Ron Sider wrote the book and then got convicted and sold his home and moved into inner city Philadelphia, because he said, if I was going to have anyone else change, I'd better change my own lifestyle. And so he moved into the ghettos and began to work. I met a little bit later a man by the name of Ray Bakke. Ray Bakke put together the presentation on Tuesday night that showed us the need of the great cities of the world. Ray Bakke challenged our hearts for 3 days as we began to realize the world is being urbanized and we'd better reach out to the cities. And Ray Bakke was challenged and speaks as probably the leading evangelical on the subject because he did it. He was called to an inner city church in Chicago, an old Scandinavian Baptist church, a church that was declining and they were about to shut. And God spoke to his heart, and Ray Bakke went there. And he said, if I'm going to reach this area, then I'd better be a part of it. And so he moved his family into the tenement. Within 1 square mile, there were over 30 languages spoken, an area where crime was at its highest. And yet he said, if God's called me there, I'd better be there. And he moved into the inner city and revitalized a church that eventually had 6 pastors and only 2 of them spoke English. For they ministered in various languages throughout the week to the people of that area. The last man I met that impacted my life in this way was a man by the name of Harvey Kahn. Harvey Kahn is an Orthodox Presbyterian, and like the two that I've just mentioned, is a professor as well at Westminster Seminary. And Harvey Kahn came to share in a class I was teaching on missions. And in that time of fellowship, he began to give his heart. He gave it away that day to the class and to me as we sat and had coffee together. He'd been a missionary 12 years in Korea and then came home, and God showed him the need of the cities. So Harvey Kahn, as he joined the seminary, said, I'd like to start an extension in the inner city of Philadelphia, that city of 4.5 million. He said, we're not going to reach the inner city unless we train people in the inner city. And then he got to thinking, how can I ask someone to come down there to go to classes if I don't live there? And so Harvey Kahn, who had paid his dues, sold his home and moved to the inner city with his family and began to minister. A few months ago, he was getting off the subway, coming from the evening classes he was conducting at that inner city extension. And as he got out and started up out of the subway station, a young black man in his early 20s walked up behind him and stuck a pistol in the back of his neck and said, give me your briefcase, give me your wallet, give me your watch, I want everything. And he realized he was being mugged. Harvey Kahn. You have the feeling at times those things are happening. Harvey Kahn turned to the young black man and said, you can't do that to me. The young black man looked at him, I've got the gun, why can't I? He said, because I'm the token white in this neighborhood. Because he lived in inner city black Philadelphia. I'm the token white. Furthermore, I'm a preacher. And furthermore, what you don't know is I am a seminary professor and my briefcase is filled with papers that students have pored over, and if you take it, you better grade them and get it back to me because they're expecting their papers back. Now he said, you can have my watch, it's not worth much, and I don't have much money, but I'll tell you what I'll do. To save you trouble and me trouble, let's go to a restaurant and I'll buy you a good meal tonight. The young mugger put his pistol inside of his coat and went with Harvey Kahn to a restaurant, and that night was won to Jesus Christ and is today a vibrant member of a church. And suddenly, My thinking changed from what are your expectations for the future to the question, what are you willing to die for? And I want to ask you that question this morning. What are you willing to die for? John chapter 12, beginning at verse 23. Jesus replied, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. The man who loves his life will lose it, while the man who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me. For where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. Now my heart is troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No. It was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Heavenly Father, in the minutes that remain this morning, may the challenge of our Savior, as He came to that crucial hour in His ministry, ring in our hearts. And the challenge that He gave to those disciples be passed on to us today as we open our hearts and your Spirit ministers. And you ask us the question, what are we willing to die for? In your name I pray. What an interesting challenge. What an interesting moment in time as He looked at His disciples and looked at the cross and He said to them, His death was to be His glory. We have a problem in the Assemblies of God today, or should I say in the Pentecostal movement. We're relatively young and we still haven't come to the place where we have confidence in ourselves. We're still trying to get from the wrong side of the tracks to the right side of the tracks mentally. Oh, we've moved there and we hear reports of churches building $5, $6, $7, $8 million structures. Broke my heart to have Brother Wagner talk about a pastor in the area that has never mothered a church, never reached out to the lost communities around there, and yet they're building a sanctuary that they are going to pay $13,000 a week interest on. That's $700,000 a year in interest money down the drain. But they're going to build that structure because the Assemblies of God has arrived. I sometimes look at some of our older denominational brethren, and I realize they've come to the place of realizing that we don't have to prove ourselves anymore. We don't have to build the structures. Oh, they built theirs. They're still around. But if we're living in those last days and God's asking us to die, I think we'd better prioritize what we're doing. And we'd better take a look at what God's speaking to the church about. Peter Kuzmik gave us a challenge these 3 days, but he didn't tell us the whole story. And that's why this morning I'd like to finish the story. You see, Peter is typical of so many missionaries. When they come and they only have a limited time, they only have so much, and there's so much they want to share, and their hearts are full. And so they pick out the highlights of their ministry, and they share it, and we get excited, and we say, look at God's doing. He's opening doors, churches of 5,000 behind the iron curtain. I mean, victory. This is fantastic. He's invited to come and teach to 700 to 800 students in an extension. I mean, that's as big as our entire student body. That's fantastic. But you see what Peter Kuzmik didn't tell us, because time wouldn't allow it, is that for every victory, there's a price tag. There's some dying that has to take place. William Carey, the father of modern missions, had his wife become terribly ill and eventually die. There was a price tag to win the world. I think of Philip and Sue Evans. They arrived in what was then Rhodesia, 2 years after we did. They were sent from the Elam Pentecostal Church in England to be school teachers in the secondary school. Their mission was operating along with their medical work and their outreach, planning churches. Phil and Sue had 3 children, two of them a school age and a 2-year-old. And as the years went by, God began to deal with Philip Evans. God began to say, I want you out of the classroom and into the churches because you have a gift of teaching and we need to train the workers, much as we just heard just a few minutes ago from Brother Dorsing. And so Phil Evans began to study so that when he went home on furlough at the end of 4 years, he would be qualified for ordination and he could come back as an ordained minister and then travel full-time in the churches, not just weekends. But in order for him to get his ordination and get his schooling done to arrive at that place, he decided to begin the college division of ICI. And being the director in that country, we began to communicate and then we began to get together as he began to take his various college-level courses. And I remember the day that Phil Evans was in the capital city. He had come there to get supplies and to visit his children, the 2 that were in the boarding school, and then stop by and drop off some work that he had done and set a time for him to write the final exam in Old Testament survey. I said, Phil, I don't know what's the best time, but let's wait for a day or two and look at our schedules and I'll write to you. And the next day it seemed that my schedule was such that I'd be in that area, for he lived a couple of 100 miles out of the capital on the eastern border with Mozambique, and war was terrible. It was difficult to travel there, and finally it worked out. I sat down and wrote him, and I said, Phil, let's set this date, and sent the letter. But that night, terrorists came on that school property, and Phil Evans, his wife Sue, their 4-year-old daughter Becky, and 10 other missionaries were brutally massacred. And he never wrote the final exam in Old Testament. We never got together. Phil Evans was promoted to glory. I looked at the chain of events that had happened in that nation in the 2 years that he'd been there, and I realized that 30 missionaries had died in those 2 years before Phil Evans, his family, and the other British missionaries gave their life that day of June 23rd of 1978. There's tremendous revival today in that nation. You look at that nation now called Zimbabwe, and churches are flourishing, and souls are being saved, and exciting things are happening, and people are saying, wow, what a day to go out there and harvest. But somebody paid the price, friends. The Phil Evanses, who realized, except a corn of wheat fall in the ground and die, it doesn't bear fruit. Our first term on the field, I was rather naive. I went out there to turn the world upside down, to see great things happen, and God blessed in a marvelous way. I had the joy last night of talking on the telephone with fellow missionaries that served with us in Zaire and are heading back on the 23rd of this month. The letter I had been trying to translate, because I've forgotten a lot of my Bengala, and the language has been in a state of change. And so I called Daryl and I said, before you leave, can you tell me what this pastor was writing to me? And the gist of it was, he, along with 6 others of the graduates that I had taught 20 years ago, were giving me a little report. What's happening? The work has almost tripled in the last 20 years. And when I first went there, I looked at what had happened in 50 years of missionary work in one of our oldest mission fields, and I thought, those people sure didn't know what they were doing, did they? I mean, we've only got 200 churches after 50 years. We've got a small handful. We're not reaching this great nation of 20-some million. Those people just didn't know how to do it. But here we are, you know, this new young generation, and we're going to really set the place afire. And when I came home 4 years later and I began to tell the report, God stopped me. God said, the only reason you've got the success story, the only reason you can talk about what I'm doing in that land and the tremendous explosion in churches and converts is because somebody went out there and died. Somebody paid the price. You followed J.W. Tucker. And they beat him to death. You followed the Penningtons. And they buried her with the ravages of malaria. You followed, and he went on down the line, and I began to realize those that were willing to die because a lost world needed Jesus Christ. And then God began to show me that success has a price tag, and that God was calling me to be willing to die. Jesus said, if you're my servant, then you've got to follow me. And my footsteps lead up Calvary's Hill. Because this is the hour God's called me to. He wrote in John chapter 20 and verse 21, as the Father sent me, I'm sending you. It's a joy to be here at Northwest College. I feel God's called me here. I couldn't be happier. My heart tugs as I look at places I'd love to go and teach in Eastern Europe. I talked to my wife about it last night. Then I thought, I don't know those languages, and I struggled enough in French and Bengala. And I'd love to be on the East Coast where my daughter and son-in-law are reaching out, for they're only 15 minutes out of New York City, and reaching the masses. But God's got me here. And it's kind of neat to step out of your front door and walk 3 minutes down to the campus. And then I got thinking last night that that's what I used to do 20 years ago. Step out the front door, walk 3 minutes, and I'm on campus. But the Bible school at Ndudu was not far away, and it became a routine until one morning I stepped out the door to get to 8 o'clock class. And as I walked out the door, a Land Rover, a British Jeep, came driving in. And in that Land Rover that day was our chef de région, the man who had the government authority over that region. With him were a number of his policemen, and they walked up to where I stood on the porch with my Bible school books under my arm, and they said to me, "We want your passport. We want so much money. We want these papers, and either you give them or you're dead." With that, one of his policeman soldiers put his rifle, his old Enfield World War I rifle, to his shoulder, walked up and put the barrel against my chest, with a sort of silly grin on his face, put his finger on the trigger, and his eyes swiveled over to his leader. What was I going to do? And I looked at the man, and I want you to know, I was not prepared to die that day. I thank God that in His wisdom He doesn't show me tomorrow. If I'd have known that the night before, I'd have been more nervous than I was this morning. I wouldn't have slept that night. But God didn't tell me until I walked out the door with my books that morning. And there in that moment, as that man looked at me, I smiled back at him. And I thought in my heart, the stupidest, craziest thing. My wife walked to the door to see what was happening. We had a great big Rhodesian Ridgeback, weighed about 90 pounds. A dog that was bred to hunt lions. I mean, you don't mess with a Ridgeback. And old Gus had the hair on the back of his neck go up, and he began to growl as the rifles were pointed. And my wife grabbed Gus and dragged him in the house and went into the front room and knelt and began to pray. And that man looked at me and he said, "Well, are you going to give it?" I said, "You have no right to my passport. Without it, I can't get out of the country. I can't do anything. I don't even have the right to move around unless I have my passport with me in this nation. And I don't have the money and I don't have all the papers. I'm sorry." And he said, "Well, then I'm going to shoot you." And the fellow with the gun with his finger on the trigger, was looking out of the corner of his eye. Nod your head. I'll do it. See, he wouldn't have to account for it. He was following orders. He wouldn't pay the price. It would be his boss. And that day, for some stupid reason, or maybe it isn't, because he said, if you're willing to die for something, I'll go with you to the very ends of the earth. And that day there was a peace in my heart, and it just popped into my mind. You poor dumb soldier, you pull the trigger, that gun's going to blow up in your face and it's going to blow your head off. I hope you don't pull the trigger, because God's got his finger in the barrel. No, I'm not a brave person. But in that moment, God was there. He only asked me to be willing to die. He didn't ask me to die. We argued for a while, and then he said, well, let's go get his children. And finally I said, it's gone far enough. You can take what I've got. And he took them, and he drove out of there with my passport and what papers we had and no money. And a week later called me to his office, and I walked in there, and he cursed me up and down, called me every vile name, and as well as several of the other Europeans who lived in that area. There were 47 of us in that 200 square mile of Zaire. And finally, I'd had enough, and I just turned around and said, excuse me, and walked out and went back home. A couple days later, he drove into the yard, never got out of the Land Rover, threw the passports in the dirt, shook his fist and said, the next time I come here, you die. And I pointed a finger, no shoe polish on it that day, right at him and said, mister, your kids are in the school right there because it's the best school in the area. And you go to that dispensary right there because it's the only place with decent medicine. And I said, I'm not here taking anything out of your country. I'm putting things in. Because the best people you govern in this region go to the Assemblies of God churches. And you have no right to threaten me. I'm here on God's business. And he drove out and disappeared. We don't know where he went. We don't know what happened. He was never heard of. And God kept building his church. But that morning, he said, Larry Malcolm, are you willing to die? For this hour, I came into the world. Father, glorify yourself. Can we sing a beautiful chorus? You know it. I'll obey to serve you. I'll obey to show I trust you. I'll obey. Bow your heads as we sing it. To serve you, I'll obey. Show I trust you. I'll obey. My life is in your hand. For it's the way to prove my love when feelings go away. Though it costs me everything, I'll obey. We're going to sing it again, young people. And God's talking to your hearts. I want to ask you this morning, what are you willing to die for? If you're willing to die for the kingdom, the rewards are beyond imagination. I don't know where he'll call you. I don't know what he's got for you, but all I know is he asks you, what are you willing to die for? And if you're willing to die for him, maybe on some mission field, maybe in some out-of-the-way place, I want you very quietly to stand as we sing it again. I'll obey. To serve you, I'll obey. To show I trust you, I'll obey. My life is in your hand. For it's the way to prove my love when feelings go away.
Though it costs me everything, I'll obey.
As we continue to sing it this morning, I'd like to invite you to these altars. Some of you have the next hour free, and God's talking to you. And it's in moments like this when we get serious with Him, and He gets down to the nitty-gritty. Not the excitement, not the expectations, but what am I willing to die for? That major decisions are made and life takes new changes. I've never regretted the places He's taken me. They've been exciting. He hasn't asked me to die like Phil Evans, like Jay Tucker. And I don't know what He has in store for you, but I know that His grace is sufficient. He's just looking for people that are willing to die for the kingdom. And I invite you to these altars as we sing it one more time in closing. I'll obey, to serve You I'll obey. So I trust You.